combat that. Now, if we fast forward to our time, this is the age of Islam. What is the miracle? What is the expertise of people, generally speaking? Thinking, rationality, it all comes down to this. If there was a better miracle than the Quran, Allah would have given it to us. The Quran is such a book that helps us to logically walk ourselves through and come to a logical explanation and understanding of life, the universe, and everything. Without that, any moron can come along and perform quote-unquote a miracle and just trick you. You'll start following his religion. But once you're logically convinced of something, there is nothing, absolutely nothing, that can sway you from it.
True.
And that's really unfortunate, you know. It's the complete book, and our own people are not aware of it. Like, you know, you have to read it, not just reading it, like you have to read the translation and its tafsir, so that the treasure in it will come out.
Yeah. Look, the Quran, it's very beautiful because Allah does highlight that these miracles took place. We parted the sea for Musa. We did this miracle. We did that miracle. We allowed Prophet Isa alayhi salam, you know, to breathe life into a form that he made out of clay, and it came to life, right? He says, we did these things. But if you look at the bulk of the arguments, you know, it's أَفَلَا تَفَكَّرُونَ. Do you not just contemplate on what is around you, the sun and the moon and the stars and the food that you eat and the rains coming down, these kinds of things?
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your input, and thank you, brothers and sisters, for being with us on today's episode of Back to Reality. I hope you enjoyed it. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer, Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
علامه طباطبایی 40 سال زندگی متأهلانه داشت.
علامه محمد حسین طباطبایی, the author of the famous exegesis of the Holy Quran al-Mizan, lived with his wife for 40 years until she passed away. When علامه طباطبایی heard the news of his wife, thus he fainted, and from that time on he had the heart disease for the rest of his life. He used to say, "When I was busy with writing the Al-Mizan exegesis of the Holy Quran, after 1 to 2 hours, my wife brought me a cup of tea and put it by my side without making the smallest noise so that I do not lose my concentration." She repeated this every 2 hours. When I recall her support for me and how she kindly treated me, I cannot stop my shedding tears upon her loss. Now, Allama Tabatabai used to visit the grave of his wife every day for 3 years and sit there for 1 hour. This shows the love of Allama Tabatabai for his wife. Even when he got a heart disease and he couldn't leave the house, he at least spent 2 days for visiting the tomb of his wife. As we can see, the love and kindness between the spouses was not only limited to the houses of the infallibles. Ordinary people can follow the example of Imam Ali and Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra and establish serenity and peace in their houses. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanallah.
Ministry. By escalating raids against the resistance factions, the United States of America is venturing to tilt the Iraqi position decisively towards the demand for a complete American withdrawal, as well as providing a strong incentive for the factions to escalate in return. The pace of escalation is rising day after day against American interests in Iraq at a time when Mustafa al-Qadhimi's government is preparing to start the fourth round of the strategic dialogue, which will discuss a complete withdrawal of the American occupation forces instead of scheduling the withdrawal as agreed upon in the third round held last April. This shift in the Iraqi position came against the backdrop of the exchange of bombings between the Americans and the resistance factions, which began from mid-June and reached the 28th of June, when an American raid targeted a camp belonging to the Popular Mobilization Forces on the border strip between Syria and Iraq. The raids of the American occupation come to save Washington's face, especially after the repeated attacks that confused the Biden administration, in addition to the security and military losses suffered by his troops. It is now clear that the purpose of the Americans' continued escalation is to drag the Iraqi factions into an all-out war inside Baghdad and then in areas south of Iraq to create internal chaos. It's worth noting that since Biden took office at the beginning of this year, most of the American bombing operations have targeted the Iraqi resistance factions inside Syria, where they operate in coordination with the Syrian Arab Army. This explains the importance of the region for Washington, especially as it represents the soft loin that Daesh exploits to restore its activity. Hence, ladies and gents, behold the American Air Force being used again as Daesh, ISIS Air Force, simply to keep Syria destabilized. The Iraqi resistance factions have retaliated by launching about 12 attacks on American occupation bases in Iraq since last February. This will for sure represent real pressure for the Iraqi government to resolve the issue of the U.S. occupation as soon as possible before the ball of confrontation rolls and burns what is left of American interests on Iraqi soil. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The pace of escalation is rising day after day against American interests in Iraq at a time when Mustafa al-Qadhimi's government is preparing to enter the fourth round of the strategic dialogue, which will discuss a complete withdrawal of the American occupation forces, instead of scheduling the withdrawal as agreed upon in the third round held last April. Now, this shift in the Iraqi position came in light of the exchange of fire between the American occupation and the resistance factions, which began in June when an American raid targeted a camp belonging to the Hashd al-Shaabi on the border strip between Syria and Iraq. Meanwhile, the American embassy in Baghdad was then targeted hours after American interests in western Iraq and other areas in neighboring Syria were similarly bombed. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammed Abed, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, by escalating these raids against the resistance factions in Iraq, the U.S. is venturing to tilt the Iraqi position decisively towards the full demand of a full withdrawal from Iraqi soil. Now, if the withdrawal is the ultimate goal for real for the American occupation, why are the Biden administration and the U.S. forces escalating their fire against the Iraqi resistance?
First of all, we have to take into account that the escalation came after the negotiations between the Iraqi government and the U.S. administration has led nowhere. So here we have a situation in which the Americans sometimes say they are withdrawing, sometimes they say they are preparing to have a training courses for the Iraqi armed forces and the Iraqi police, and etc. Other times they you see them barricading in their embassy, which is a huge on huge size of the land in Baghdad. So you cannot make be sure about this issue that the Americans want to withdraw. Now, when you deal with a country as such, this means you are telling the other, the people of this country, that you are an occupation force, and consequently they are going to deal with you as such. So The Americans all the time are trying to portray the issue as that the Iranians are the Iranian-backed militias are targeting our interests and our bases in Iraq. If you note how much they pump this propaganda war in this regard, you will understand that people are tending to forget that the Americans are an occupation force in Iraq, and consequently they are going to be dealt with likewise, meaning mm-hmm. as an occupation force. So these are the main things that we need to take into account whenever we are tackling the issue. Now you see that the Americans are getting a lot of strikes from the Iraqi resistance. We need to underline the word resistance mm-hmm. because there's an occupation force, and consequently they cannot retaliate with the way that, for instance, Trump would have wanted. And even if Trump was there, and I mean the Trump administration, the American army would not, and the American Navy would not agree to an escalation because they know about their weaknesses in Iraq. They know about their weaknesses that have come in the last decade in the region and in the whole world as in general.
Mr. Mohammed, what's very interesting is that since the beginning of this year, we have seen more than 50 attacks. One were actually said that happened by the U.S. administration. Others they were silent about that targeted U.S. interests in Iraq, especially the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, the Iraqi military bases that house U.S. troops in them, and the Erbil airport as well. We all remember that. In attacks often always attributed to the Iraqi resistance forces. In the event these attacks just increase and continue targeting U.S. occupation forces in Iraq, how do you think that the Iraqi government will maneuver around this fact in the upcoming talks?
Well, you have to take into account the complications that Mr. Kazemi is facing. You know, the Kazemi is what sort of a figure that was chosen to be in the middle between all parties, and you cannot be such a person and such a politician when you have a very complicated situation as the one in the Middle East in general, and specifically in Iraq, between all these forces that are around you. I mean, the Islamic Republic of Iran neighboring you, and you have the American administration and American troops occupying Baghdad. You have the Saudis intervening from here or there. You have other Gulf countries also. So it's a very complicated situation. And you notice that the Iraqi government is trying to please everyone. Whenever an American strike takes place, they criticize, for instance, slightly. But when the resistance retaliates, they try to make the those who carried out the operation as people who are not known, etc. Mm-hmm. So they are in a very, very in a real dilemma in this regard, in order how to deal with issues, because the issues are going in a very fast pace, and they cannot deal with the situation because of all of its old complications.
Well, it should be noted there, Mr. Mohammed, that since the Biden administration took the presidency in the U.S. At the beginning of this year, most of the American bombing campaigns have targeted the factions, Iraqi factions, Iraqi resistance inside Syria, where they coordinate with the Syrian Arab Army their operations there, because it is the perfect spot, the soft loin that Daesh, ISIS, usually exploits to try and restore its activity. How on earth does the world not condemn the U.S. basically being Daesh Air Force there? They are playing the role of protecting the area for ISIS to return to that area. How does the world just keep silent?
Well, the world is keeping silent because of the American hegemony over the media all over the world. And so things are quite clear in this regard. I mean, even when you go back to the times when I know this has been reiterated a lot, the Trump declaration that it was Clinton who created Daesh, and on the issue of the scandal of the emails, etc. But still, the whole world knows, and even Iraqis sometimes had videotapes and footage of the American helicopters just withdrawing the ISIS militiamen from certain areas and moving them to other areas. So the whole world knows, but remains silent, as is the case with the Palestinian issue, which is completely a just cause, and the whole world is turning the blind eye to that, the Israeli massacres, and the situation in Lebanon with the American pressures and so that are starving people here. So all over the world you have right is right and wrong is wrong, and things are right clear. But unfortunately, the American administration is sort of terrorizing and bullying all the media and all over the world, and all the politicians all over the world. Some of them subdue to the pressure, others reject this, and consequently would be confronting the American interests and American plans. But unfortunately, most of the world is just subduing to these pressures by the Americans.
Well, the dilemma of the White House is that it sees maintaining a small, what they call a focused mission inside of Iraq and inside of Syria as well, a worthwhile alternative to a complete full withdrawal of their forces. Yet, obviously, the Iraqi resistance will not stop its fight back. They will always keep targeting the U.S. occupation forces as long as they remain there. And obviously, we've seen similar attacks against their bases in Syria as well. How do you think the Iraqi resistance will receive a possible decision by the U.S. to relocate from Baghdad and maybe go forward northwards Kurdistan? How will they deal with that?
Well, I'm sure also the strategists of the I'm not going only to talk about the Iraqi resistance here. I'm talking about the axis of resistance in the whole region is reading very clearly the strategic weaknesses that have grown up and grown in the as far as the American administration is concerned in the whole region and in the whole world in general. We are talking about military wise and economically and in many other domains. So you have to take into account all these things and disregard whatever the Americans are trying to spread in their propaganda and in their media about their aim to help and assist the poor Iraqi people. They are trying to assist us here in Lebanon, I mean, with besieging us and banning us from getting any necessities that we need to live as a people. So the Americans are doing one thing and on the one hand, and quite the opposite on the other, and while all the time claiming to be the force of good in the whole world, which is the utmost contrast of truth and
Well, I want to thank difference. You very much, Mr. Mohammed Abed, political commentator, for joining us talk about the latest attacks against U.S. occupation forces in Iraq and possibly also in the future in Syria. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about the life and the loss of a Palestinian leader in Damascus. Stay with us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
A fighter. This is how Ahmed Jibril spent his stormy life, witnessing the smallest details of the Palestinian struggle ever since the Zionist gangs of the first settlers uprooted the pillars of his family home in the village of Yazur near Jaffa in 1948 when he was just 10 years old. Since then, Jibril finally chose to cover his face with the dust of Damascus after he had discovered the secrets of geography between Palestine and the Levant interior and learned the language of the water flowing towards the south with bullets and longing to return to the basil and lemon gardens in Yazur. Jibril was laid to rest in his beloved Damascus last week after decades of struggle for liberation that seems today closer than ever because of the thoughts and activism of the likes of late Ahmed Jibril. More in the following report.
On a sad day, July 7, 2021, a great Palestinian icon, Ahmed Jibril Abu Jihad, one of the founders of the Contemporary Palestinian Revolution and the Palestine Liberation Organization, passed away in Damascus. With his departure, the Palestinian National Movement and the Palestinian people, as well as the Arab and Islamic nation and the free people of the world, lost a stubborn fighter who did not know despair nor submission. The idea of fighting for Palestine persisted over Jibril's purpose in life. Instead of pursuing higher education, he joined the Syrian army and moved to the military college in Cairo to graduate as a combat lieutenant. Jibril quickly used his knowledge in order to build a force of fidayeen, Fighters for Palestine to revenge the taking of Palestine by illegal settlers and the Zionist Occupation Army. He contributed to the establishment of the Palestine Liberation Front and then the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Jibril's bias towards geography was a sufficient reason to establish the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command in 1968, and to separate from the Popular Front and before it from the Fatah movement and its leader Yasser Arafat. He instead chose an alliance with the late President Hafez al-Assad in 1970, an alliance that Jibril remained loyal to until he descended on Friday, July 7, under the soil of the Cemetery of the Martyrs in Yarmouk camp, south of Damascus. Throughout the years of conflict, the general command did not miss the fateful battles. From fighting at home in Palestine to confronting the enemy in Lebanon, Jibril planned, organized, led, and won most of the battles he fought. From the Hotel War against the forces of the Lebanese Front at that time, which was fought in Beirut with the support of the occupation army, to facing the 1982 invasion of Lebanon on most of the battlefronts, from the south to the coastal line to the capital and Hamdoun to the central Biqa', especially in the famous battles of Sultan Yaqub to the famous Mountain War, in which the general command and the Syrian artillery were involved with great influence, so the battle against the Lebanese forces militia was decided at the time. As for the icon of Jibril's achievements, it was the gliders operation in 1987, which aimed to reach an occupation camp in the Galilee using gliders launched from Lebanon. This military achievement was one of the reasons for the outbreak of the First Intifada that year, in which Jibril and the General Command played a prominent role in fueling it and providing it with moral and material support. Ahmed Jibril excelled in everything. His deep political vision prompted him to root the General Command's relations with the various resistance factions and parties that engaged in fighting, especially Hezbollah and the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, where they all carried out several joint operations. Ahmed Jibril did not leave his two sons, Jihad and Khalid, trust funds and palaces. Rather, they inherited a life project that ends with death solely for Palestine.
Now, to discuss the life of this brave man with us from Damascus is Mr. Tahsin Al-Halabi, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Tahsin. Now, late Ahmed Jibril's bias towards geography was a sufficient reason to establish the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the General Command, in 1968. How do you view the contribution of late Jibril to the fight to liberate Palestine?
You know, in the beginning, Comrade Jibril, he vowed all his life for Palestine, for liberating Palestine. And he also vowed the lives of his four children for Palestine, for liberating Palestine. He lost one, Jihad, the oldest one, as a revenge from the Israeli occupation when they targeted him in Beirut on 2002 in Beirut, because they knew that he was the one that sent from the Sea of Beirut to Gaza lot of weapons and lot of explosives and rockets for the revolution, for the resistance of the Palestinian factions in Gaza. Mm-hmm. Jibril's legacy really is very rich, very also deep in the roots of this resistance. From the beginning, he found that there was no way but to go to the military academy on 1957 to Egypt. In the beginning, he volunteered to the Syrian army, and he made course for to be an officer, and then he requested to go to the Academy of Cairo in order to get more knowledge about guerrilla warfare, not for conventional armies and conventional weapons for armies, He went there in order to get the background of military activities, of military operations, and then he turned by himself to the knowledge of the expertise of the guerrilla warfare. For this reason, he was the one that graduated from the Academy of Egypt in the specialty of mines and engineering military positions and wireless also communications.
Well, Mr. Tahsin, in relation to the current events happening at the moment as we speak in occupied Palestine, how do you think the mental mull of Ahmed Jibril can affect the current wave of revolution against the occupation and also against the police state now cracking down on the Palestinian natives?
Jibril knew his road very well, and he knew the ways of how to confront the occupation forces. Therefore, when the Oslo Accords was signed by PLO leadership and Israel, he was the one that called all the Palestinian masses inside occupied Palestine to protest, to be against such accords, and to try to make any way to go to the road of resistance. From that moment, he started to receive hundreds of Palestinian youth from West Bank and Gaza Strip in Damascus, in the headquarters of the PFLP General Command, and they were trained here for few weeks or more than 2 months from Hamas and from Jihad Islami. Many young Palestinian individuals, Palestinian fida'iyin, came here to his headquarters in Damascus, in Syria, and were getting all the making how of explosives, of weapons, of rockets, of lot of things, and so he made certain
he embodied the real resistance of the Palestinians
In front of them.
Mr. Tahsin, Jibril believed that Palestine is an Arab issue, and he rejected all attempts to isolate it from its Arab depth because of his belief that the liberation of Palestine is an Arab task and not only a Palestinian task. Because the Zionist danger does not threaten the Palestinian people alone, it threatens all of us and even goes past the Arab world. Where do you see the current Arab position from all the new changes happening inside Palestine right now?
From the beginning, he knew very well that no faction alone or with other factions, with other Palestinian factions, can liberate Palestine by his own capabilities and military equipments and military activities. He knew that the Palestinian factions should be the spear of the Arab armies that will participate in any war against the occupation forces inside Palestine. He wanted that those factions to be the pioneers on the road of guerrilla war against the Israeli occupation, whether inside Palestine or across the borders, from Jordan, from the Golan Heights boundaries, from South Lebanon, from Gaza, from all those boundaries surrounding Palestine. He tried to prepare such activities and giving trainings, military trainings for hundreds of Palestinians in order to do that. But not believing at all that the only Palestinian factions can liberate Palestine. He needed the Arab armies surrounding Palestine, occupied Palestine, to participate and to share with this victorious war against
Mr. Tahsin Al-Halabi. Mr. Tahsin Al-Halabi, a political commentator, we celebrate today a man like Mr. Ahmed Jibril, and we celebrate men like you who have a great history in a struggle against the Zionist occupation on the road to the freedom of Palestine. Thank you very much for joining us from Damascus to celebrate with us this fallen hero. Thank you very much for being with us, and please stay tuned next week for more from our Mideast stream.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today we're going to be speaking about the necessity of prophethood, the necessity of the divine revelation, and why it is necessary and obligatory upon God to send his message to humanity through the prophets and through divine revelation. We were examining this problem from the point of view that human beings, in order for them to be happy, in order for them to be fulfilled and to achieve felicity in this world and in the hereafter, they have to have a knowledge and understanding of their Creator. They have to have a knowledge of God. This knowledge of God is not something that they can arrive at on their own. They have to be assisted by God Himself. He has to introduce Himself to human beings so that they can understand who He is, so that they can understand who He is, and so that they can be fulfilled and happy spiritually and mentally and physically and in every way in this world and in the hereafter. We said that there was an objection here that some people raised, and that objection was this. We saw and we see that in history there were human beings who, without the assistance of divine revelation, were able to arrive at the same conclusions that the divine revelation teaches us, right? They thought about the matter, right? And they came to the conclusion that God exists. They thought about the matter, they came to the conclusion that God is one, that He has knowledge, that He has life, that He has power, right? That He is the creator of the world, and so on and so forth. So they were able to arrive at the same conclusions that the divine revelation speaks about without the assistance of divine revelation. Right? So this shows us that there is no need for prophethood and divine revelation. We examined this question from a number of different points of view. Today we want to examine it from another point of view. And that's this, that let's say that these human beings did arrive at this conclusion, these conclusions, and they arrived at the same conclusions and the knowledge of God that revelation speaks about. But we have to examine how did they do this? How did they use their faculties of reasoning and their minds and their intellects to arrive at these conclusions? None of these human beings arrived at these conclusions straight away. First of all, it took time for their intellects to blossom. Right? They didn't know about God when they were children. When they became adults, they started to ponder over the matter. They arrived at this conclusion. Secondly, these human beings, we see, when we look at the history of their thought, these great thinkers, they didn't arrive at these conclusions straight away, right? First of all, we see that one of these thinkers, let's say a certain philosopher, in the beginning of his life, he might have been an atheist or he might have been an agnostic, right? He arrived at certain conclusions, which he later on found out were untrue. This process of reasoning and thinking that he went through before he became a monotheist, before he became a Gnostic, before he became a mystic, right? It was a long process. Certain thinkers only arrived at these beliefs in the end of their lives, towards the end of their lives, right? So this shows us that this was not something that they immediately arrived at. So maybe in the beginning of their lives, they were misguided. They were misguided. They were on the wrong path. They didn't believe in God, or they didn't believe that there was the human being had the ability to understand God. And maybe they were polytheists, but later became monotheists, right? So the question arises, what about the times before they had arrived at the belief in God? Was there not need for divine revelation before that? We can't say that God can leave human beings to think about these matters on their own and arrive at these conclusions at the end of their lives. No, human beings need to be spiritually and intellectually fulfilled throughout their lives, right? So there is a need for a divine revelation. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the necessity of prophethood and revelation. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام ثلاث لا يزيد الله بهن المرأة المسلم إلا عزا: الصفح عمن ظلمه، وإعطاء من حرمه، والصلة لمن قطعه.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "There are three things through which Allah only increases the Muslim in honor: his pardon of one who has wronged him, his giving one who has deprived him, and his reconciliation with one who has cut him off.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find that Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam, peace be upon him, has talked about a great many things in his conversations and in his dialogues with his companions, his friends, his family, his relatives, and the people in general. In one such conversation, Imam al-Baqir really says something which is beautiful. Of course, every single thing that Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, this divinely appointed Imam, has spoken about is truly beautiful. But this one stood out to me. In this conversation, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam, urges his companions and the Muslims in general to supplicate to Allah, to do dua, as it is said in Arabic. And so Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, surely, definitely, most certainly, Allah hates that people insist upon each other for their requests. Meaning, we go to a certain person and we continuously and consistently just keep on requesting and asking and begging and pleading and supplicating and beseeching another human being for our needs. Consistently, constantly, incessantly. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam said, Allah hates that people insist upon each other for their requests. However, Allah, exalted be His name, loves this for Himself. Allah wants people to ask Him for what He has with insistence, continuously, consistently. How very beautiful, dear friends, we find here in this conversation between Imam al-Baqir and his companion, where Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon this divinely appointed Imam, is telling us, is advising us, is encouraging us to always and consistently be asking for our needs from Allah. So, dear friends, never get tired. Never become hopeless when it comes to asking your needs from Allah. Truly, who else is there who can give us what we need, who can give us what we desire, who can give us more than we can imagine? Surely it is Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, who gives us these things, what we need, and even more. So continue to knock upon the door of the most generous of the generous, the ultimate generous, the perfect generous, Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
One of the distinction of this, you know, line of imams compared to the other schools of thought is the direct and straight channel to Rasulullah and his seerah. It was the fifth imam, the first time. And of course, his son also repeated the same words, that whenever I narrate something and I don't give you a sanad, I do not give you the chain of narration, you can assume that what I'm saying has come from my father. And what he said comes from his father, Hussein bin Ali. What he said comes from Amirul Mu'mineen, and from Ali it comes from Rasulullah, and whatever Rasulullah says comes from Jibreel, and whatever Jibreel conveys to the Rasul is by the command of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the fifth and the sixth imam, you know, you will see, they will just say Qala Rasulullah. They will not go through the process of sanad. Except in one case, in the life of the fifth imam, and that's very interesting, and there is a real reason behind it. Our fifth imam actually narrates the hadith of Saqalain through a channel which is not of the Ahlul Bayt, a channel of the Sahabi of the Prophet who lived longest. He says that I have been told by Jabir bin Abdullah al-Ansari, who says that Rasulullah said, Inni tarikum fikum al-saqalain, kitab Allah wa itrati ahlu bayti. Some of the ulama actually mentioned that this is an exceptional sanad in the statements of the fifth imam. He never, you know, goes through Sahaba. But there was a reason. This is hadith al-saqalain. This is one of the main, you know, bases of the vilayat of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And there is an accusation from the other side. They say, well, you know, their statements of our fifth and sixth imam, they call it mursal. Mursal means narration of the prophet which doesn't have sanad between the narrator and the prophet because they didn't see them. So this is mursal that doesn't have any value. But since this was a controversial issue between the Mabahib, Imam wanted to do Itmam Hujjat. That now I'm not talking about our internal, you know, Salsala that we have in the family. You know, now I'm going through your Salsala here, and the Sahabi who lived the longest, who brought the Salam of Rasulullah, my grandfather, to me, he was there. And he himself, you know, heard Rasulullah saying, Inni tarikum fikum al-saqalain, kitab Allah wa itrati ahlu bayt.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
All those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. We're in a very special period of time. We are in the month of Hajj. The month of Zilhijjah is a very important month, a very important time. It is also one of the four months of Haram, or the forbidden months, in which, as we know, during the time of Jahiliyyah or the time of ignorance, it was forbidden for people to fight. It was a time where people would kind of get on with their own things. It is also the month where we as Muslims, if we have the ability to do so, to partake in the divine pilgrimage, the compulsory pilgrimage for some, to the house of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the holy city of Mecca, and to visit the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and his family members in the city of Medina. The divine pilgrimage of Hajj, where we, you know, make the objective of our being during that particular time only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And there is nothing else that should be the objective. In the coming days, you know, inshallah, we have the ability and the opportunity to sit and read the dua of Imam Hussein alayhi salam on the day of Arafah, and so on and so forth. So this is a very important time, my dear brothers and sisters. And there are certain, you know, secrets behind these actions that we do, that hopefully, inshallah, the book that we hope to introduce to you will elucidate and try to show you some of these secrets. Inshallah, until our next segment, please stay tuned.
Labbaik Allahumma labbaik.
Labbaik Allahumma labbaik.
Labbaik la sharika laka.
Labbaik la sharika laka.
Innal hamda.
Innal hamda.
Wa ni'mata.
Wa ni'mata.
Laka wal mulk.
Laka wal mulk. La sharika.
Welcome back to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. We have been discussing Hajj being at this moment in time in the month of Zilhijjah, and saying that Hajj is not just a ritual gathering. No, there are certain objectives, secrets, you know, things that are behind that particular ritual that a person does. The book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is titled Secrets of the Hajj. It is written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma, Sheikh Hussein Mazahiri, who is one of the great scholars who are currently residing in the city of Isfahan. He is also the head of the seminary in Isfahan. The book obviously was in Farsi and translated into English by Sheikh Salim Bimji, and was published by the Islamic Humanitarian Service, or IHS, which is based in Canada. The book begins with a brief biography of the author by Brother Salim Bimji, or Sheikh Salim Bimji. So he describes the author, his biography, and so on and so forth. He then introduces the book. And then the book, which is not a very big book, it is a small book, more like a booklet, describes the three stages of Hajj. And he goes into it. Where inshallah, we will be mentioning the first stage of the Hajj when we read a section from this book. What is also good about this book is that it provides a visual of the certain places a person will go to while performing the Hajj. For example, around the Kaaba, there are certain historical places or rather, you know, positions of important things. For example, the footprint of Ibrahim alayhi salam, and so on and so forth, or what is known as the Maqam al-Ibrahim, and other places around the Kaaba, such as the Zamzam, and the certain doors that a person can exit from, enter from, and so on and so forth. The author sketches out General Baqi, where the graves are, who is buried where, and then also the city of Mecca in a larger scale. So this is the contents of the book, and inshallah, in our next segment, we will be reading a portion of this very beautiful and concise book by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Mazahiri. Inshallah, please stay tuned.
All across ocean it lives, incumbent on all men, is the pilgrimage to Mecca, fifth pillar of Islam, in the footsteps of Muhammad, the last prophet of Allah.